Still no sign of the missing coastal trader, the Blythe Star, which is overdue on a voyage from Hobart to Grassy in King Island, where it was expected to arrive on Sunday.
The last contact we had with the vessel was Friday evening, when the captain indicated that he was going up the west coast of Tasmania to King Island. But he could have decided, when he got out to sea, that the weather was breaking up in such a way that it could have been more appropriate for him to turn around and go up the east coast. He may have done that, we just don't know.
Neil Batt, Chief Secretary and Minister for Transport in Tasmania in 1973, speaking on AM about the loss of the ship, the Blythe Star. I'm Anne Jones, with you on Conversations while Richard is away for a couple of weeks, and I'm moonlighting from my day job on Radio National, presenting a program called Off Track. Last year on my off-track travels, I came across the story of the Blythe Star. In 1973, she left a port in Hobart and all was well. She was under charter to the Tasmanian Transport Commission, carrying superphosphate and beer to King Island. But somewhere along the way, the ship capsized. She went down into the depths of the ocean. Gone. All 10 crew members got out alive, just by the skin of their teeth, and they started to drift across the ocean in a life raft. They had a couple of stale biscuits, some tins of water, and that's it. They were adrift. No radio and no one on land knew where they were. Not all of them would survive the ordeal that followed. And Michael Dolman is now the only surviving member of the Blythe Star crew. I recorded this conversation with Michael Dolman last year. He hadn't talked at length about the rescue before, but he remembered this experience so vividly, even though it had happened way back in the 1970s. Michael was a bit of a tearaway as a kid, and he told me that going away to sea was the best thing that could have happened to him.
I first worked in an abattoirs in Dandenong, and actually in Doveton, right across the road. My mum worked there and she got me a job. And I was dying to get away to sea. My father was a seafarer. So I went away to sea in 1970 at the age of just turned 16.
So really young.
Yeah, oh, very young. And but best thing I've ever done.
And what was it like? What sort of work were you doing?
Well, I was a deck boy, so I was the youngest in the crew, and my job was to maintain the ship, work under directions from the bosun, which is like a foreman in a maritime vernacular, splicing ropes, splicing wires, painting, learning how to steer the ship, just general functions to keep the ship well-maintained and in a safe order.
A bit hard graft?
Not really. I mean, I liked hard work. That didn't bother me at all. I've always been a hard worker, so that I enjoyed it. And how can you get anything better than that? Working out in the elements at sea with nothing around you but blue, blue water and blue skies, sometimes rain and bad weather, but a whole mosaic of beautiful environment.
And what sort of vessels were you working on?
Well, my first vessel was a ship called the Solon. It was a shell tanker, and I joined it in Geelong. And it was, at that time, one of the largest ships in Australia. It was a 78,000-tonne oil tanker. And it was the first time in my life I'd had a room on my own. I grew up with four brothers in a room. And I joined this ship at about 6 p.m. at night. About 5:30 at night. Dinner was just on. And I'll never forget it. Steak was on. I had never eaten steak in my life up until that point. So I chopped into this big T-bone steak. They could see that I was chafing at the bit to have a crack at another one. I ended up eating three T-bone steaks. And then I waddled off to my cabin and on my own in this beautiful cabin with a bathroom and toilet next to it, I just fell asleep in heaven.
I had no idea it was so idyllic. I was under the understanding that there were cramped conditions aboard these ships and things like that. You're making it sound, it surely can't be all that good.
No, well, that was a new ship, so it was fantastic. But I went from there, I flew down to Hobart to join the next ship, which was the North Esk. And then a taxi dropped me off at the wharf, North Wharf, near the silos down there where the Aurora Australis now ties up. And I couldn't see any ship. And then I walked closer to the edge of the wharf, and there it was, under the wharf. It was the tiniest little ship you've ever seen in your life. And I went from single accommodation to shared accommodation to cramped, uncomfortable ship at sea. but a lovely crew, and that compensates for all of those, comfort creatures that disappear on those older ships. So yes, I had a mixture of ships. I sailed on Bass Strait, I sailed overseas, I sailed on oil rig tenders, I sailed on general cargo ships, bulkies, tugs, a whole raft of them, and some were good, some were not so good. But the life of a seafarer is a great life. And yes, you have the elements, and yes, you have the risks and the danger, but that's all part of the great mosaic of going away to sea.
How do you actually move from ship to ship? How do you keep work constant in that sort of environment?
Well, I've been in the office of the Maritime Union, formerly the Seamen's Union, now since 1984. In those days, there was an engagement centre where you would do your period of time on the ship. If you were permanent, you just went on leave, you came back, it was just like a routine. If you're a casual or a reliever, you'd do your relief, you'd complete your duty, your responsibilities, you'd pay off the ship, then you would put yourself on the roster, and then you would be allocated by the government agency, Marine Crews, to a ship. You could volunteer to take ships, but if nobody wanted it, you were, as they called, shanghaied into that ship. So it was a bit of an art form. Some people who really knew how to work that system and Shanghai people, and others were quite lucky and got some good jobs. But I never picked and choose too much. I just was happy to get a job and a new ship and new mates to meet.
And how was it that you came to be on the Blythe Star?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story in one respect. I was on the roster, and it was one of those occasions I didn't want to go to sea. I just met this beautiful woman, who's now my wife, Joni McGrath at the time, and she was a honey, and I'd lucked out. I'd done really well, so it was her birthday, her 16th birthday. So I arranged for a river cruise on Melbourne on the Yarra. On the Argonaut was the name of the vessel. And there's a bit of a link between that and because the Argonaut was originally owned by the same mob that owned the Blythe Star. Anyway, this used to do river cruises up and down the river for functions and dinners and what have you, and I'd booked the dinner for my girlfriend and myself. I got shanghaied on the Friday. I put a bit of an argument on about it, nothing I could do, and I went down, joined the ship in Hobart, and while I was struggling to survive, my now wife was partying and having a cake party at her house with her family and friends, oblivious to the circumstances I was going through at exactly the same time.
So what happened? You got aboard, and then what happened?
Well, I joined the ship. It was a very small ship, 320 tonnes, that was carrying superphosphate in bags and keg beer and other bits and pieces to King Island. We sailed late afternoon on the 12th of October. I had a helm duty during the night, up early hours, and then at about 8:30, the ship took a starboard list, that's to the right. It corrected itself, then it took a further list, which was a death roll. It just went over. I got thrown out of the bunk. My colleague who shared the cabin with me, Mick Power, was on the wheel. And as I looked out of the porthole, it was just water. The porthole and that side of the ship was immersed in water. The weather was quite calm. It was just rolling swell with a pretty overcast day. However, when I got to the alleyway to get out of the ship, there was water pouring in from the companionway on the poop deck. And so I started heading aft to get up that companionway to get out on deck. I bumped Malcolm McCarroll, one of the seafarers in the laundry, trying to shut a porthole. And we never spoke a word, but we just looked at each other and knew it was wasting his time doing that job. So I put my hand out, pulled him. And we both got out on the poop deck, and by this time the ship was almost at a 90-degree list on the starboard side.
Did they ever know why? What happened?
Well, the Court of Marine Inquiry was very scathing on the company. In fact, when they were loading the ship in Tasmania, in Hobart, we joked with the wharfies that the plimsoll line, which is a line that designates how far your ship can be loaded to, we were joking that the plimsoll line was on the funnel because the cargo on deck, cargo down below, it was just an enormous amount of cargo. But the real problem was that the general rolling of the ship and the phosphate was on pallets and plastic bags. So plastic against plastic, it slipped, and once cargo moves, you can't get it back. It's impossible. So that's what happened, and that was the contributing factor, among other things, but that was the main one. The cargo shifted in the hull, and the ship turned over. Now, I can tell you there's nothing more frightening than standing on a platform, in this case a ship for me, and slowly watching it disappear from under you, and there is nothing within cooey. The lifeboats were unserviceable. You couldn't get them out because of the list of the vessel. The bosun was having a terrible time trying to get the life raft to relaunched, and I was in a pair of jocks and a singlet. No, sorry, a pair of jocks, having been thrown out of the bunk, and the water was freezing, and the ship was just going further down and further down, and there was just... It's just the most scariest thing you could imagine, having your platform disappear from under you, and at that minute, not much looking in your favour. Well, thankfully, the bosun, Stan Leary, got the life raft over the side, and we all got into the raft. And I was probably last in off the deck, and I was preparing to disconnect the painter, which attached the ship to us, or us to the ship. Something he didn't want to be. And the chief officer, Ken Jones, came swimming out from under the accommodation, and we pulled him on board, got rid of the painter. We drifted probably 20, 30 metres with the wind, and the ship just came up on its stern and just disappeared, with the stern going first and then slowly, and the bow disappeared. Spectacular sight. If nothing else, a spectacular sight. But and of course, we were quite happy that we're all safe in the life raft, and we figured that we would be rescued pretty soon. Not to be the case.
So it's a blow-up sort of raft. There's 10 of you in it. Did you have provisions? What was in there?
Well, these rafts are thankfully pretty sturdy vessels. They're round by nature, and they've got a canopy on top. They're not the most comfortable thing to be in, but certainly better than not being in one at all. And you have provisions. You have barley sugar, some biscuits and tin water, and a medical supply, and some patches and bales and all that stuff, and paddles to manipulate. In those days, there was no EPIRBs on ships, and we found out once we got settled in the life raft, There'd be no Mayday set off. The captain didn't get a Mayday away. So nobody knew that we had sunk and were in a life raft. It got worse once we started to sort of take stock of our circumstance. We also asked, did we tell them what route we were taking? Because it wasn't all that unfamiliar for the captain to make a decision once he got down to Tasman Island whether to go east or west about, depending on the prevailing weather. So he didn't tell anybody when he left the wharf. Nobody knew. And he had chosen to go west about. And that's where we sunk. Not because he took that route, but nobody knew. So what happened when... So we figured that, well, they don't know which route we took, but they expect it to be 2 or 3 days max, and then they'd start thinking about it, thinking about looking for us. So we were all pretty comfortable that that would happen. And days just went into days and days, and we just came to the conclusion that they don't know which way we went, so the search pattern would be be doubled in terms of trying to find us. And it was the biggest search in maritime history at that time, and we saw only one plane, which was far, far away, and no other search vehicle, vessel or plane during that whole period of time.
I went searching in the ABC archives to see what I could find about the Blythe Star, and I was looking all through 1973 and just after the accident, and I found the young man, Michael Dolman, and some of the other crew members.
I was in bed asleep. I'd come off the 2 to 4 watch, and it was about 8 o'clock, 8:15, something like that, when I felt it roll over to the starboard side. Fell out of my bunk.
You felt it rolling?
I felt it slide over to the side, yeah, and I fell out of my bunk. Had a look at the porthole, it was all water. Then I sort of climbed out of my cabin, started climbing down the alleyway, and there was all water pouring down it. I seen Malcolm McCarroll, he was in the laundry trying to batten down a porthole. But she just couldn't get rid of water. It was just water kept coming in. So we looked
How deep was it?
The water in the alleyway, about 2 foot. And it was coming in faster and faster.
Is it pretty hard to get out?
Oh, not when you're trying, it's not. And we took off up the stairs, climbed up onto the side of the ship, and got the life raft away and cleared it and then got away, and she went down stern first.
Ordinary seaman Michael Dolman. It was also first time aboard for the cook, Alfred Simpson.
We all got clear within about 5 minutes.
How long did it take for the ship to go down?
Well, we got the life raft, I suppose, 5 or 6 minutes.
Why do you think it went down? Did it hit a big rock or anything?
Look, honestly, I couldn't say. I'm not a seaman or anything. I'm only a cook, and this is my first trip at sea.
Alfred Simpson was the cook from the Blythe Star, talking on AM back in 1973. So you're afloat, you do have some fresh water, you've got some biscuits, some barley sugar. How was your welfare?
We were okay. Of course, we were quite buoyed by the fact we're all alive and all in the life raft, and we weren't overly concerned our life was in risk at that point. You know, we were cold, but we all huddled up together. It's the only time I've taken great comfort in another man cuddled up to me, or vice versa, so we could all keep warm. But then we had a tragedy. John Sloan, who was the second engineer, was never, never comfortable in the raft, and he passed away. And I still don't know to this day what the cause of it was. Exposure in the main and cold. We all made a determination to keep his body in the raft with us, in the expectations that we would be rescued in due course, and we could send his body home to his family to be appropriately buried and what have you. Unfortunately, time went on, and that wasn't available to us. I think the captain said a few Christian words or whatever, and we slipped his body over the side, and I thank John because he had a singlet that I had took before we put him over the side, and I knew damn well that he would be more than happy with that, and a pair of socks actually. He'd be more than happy about that for his fellow shipmates to use a bit of his clothing to keep warm. So that was a real low, and we sort of dipped into a degree of depression and weren't talking too much to each other. But we have things to do. We had to continue the morale. We had to continue to keep the boat, the raft dry. The weather was absolutely appalling. And at times the raft would concertina into itself, and you'd have the people on the left and right-hand sides of the raft smashing into each other. We'd have enormous waves bursting through the canopy. So we had to get the water out, continually keeping the water out. We were wet the whole time. We had to keep lookouts, so we used to open a little part of the canopy so someone could keep their head out. And all of us had been regular Bass Strait shippers, seafarers, so we knew the routes of the seaway vessels and that would come down to Hobart on a regular basis. So we sort of had a bit of time on that. But then we had weather that just kept blowing us further and further south, and if we kept going, we would have ended up in Heard Island or Antarctica. It was extremely cold, no sign of any land, not even birds. And if you can't see birds at sea, you're a fair way from land. And the current and prevailing weather changed and brought us back up to Shooten Island, which is on the eastern side of Tasmania. So we travelled all the way up there. I was on lookout one night, and we also knew there was a lot of Japanese fishing boats that worked in that area. And we could see a Japanese fishing boat. It was lit up like a Christmas tree with the lights on deck. And we shot flares off. It started coming in our direction. We shot flares off, and the vessel turned and disappeared. And that was shattering stuff. We figured... I'd like to cut them some slack and say they didn't see it because of the deck lights, but I'm finding it very hard to do so, and I haven't done for all those years. We think they turned and took off because they weren't supposed to be where they were fishing. Not that what would have bothered us under those circumstances. So we never see much shipping at all, And then once we got up to Shooting Island, we drifted all the way back down again to back down to Tasman Island. We were so close to Tasman Island, you could not see the lighthouse or anything on top of the island. If you know that particular, it's a very, very high island out of the water. So then we drifted south again, and for another few days, and then we had the fortune of drifting very, very close back towards Tasman border, but also heading northeast. Northwest, heading closer to the shore along there, and there's these massive big rock formations called the Lanterns. And they're like pinnacles that come out of the ocean with gaps between them where the water just runs through them. And Mick Power was paddling, and we're in really good spirits because we're making great headway, and we sort of opened the canopy a little bit to act like a sail to pull us along as well. And Mick said, "I think you better have a look at this. We're getting too close to these Lanterns." So I said, "Dad, just keep going, mate. We're going fine." He said, "I think someone better have a look." So I stuck my head out because he was paddling on his own. We had two paddles. And I couldn't believe what I seen. We were almost on top of this. In fact, I said to Mick, "Do you think we can get through one of those gaps between these pinnacles?" And it was overly optimistic. No way in the world. So I don't know where we got the strength from, because we're probably into our eighth day by this. We paddled like madmen. And others were massaging our cramps in our ankle, in our calf muscles. We just hammered it and got around the last of the Lanterns pinnacle and drifted into the bay. Well, both Mick and I just collapsed with exhaustion, and it was the first big blue he actually had in the raft, because we said to others, "It's your responsibility to keep it going now," and I won't say who it was, but and I think we were a little bit harsh, and temper's a bit frayed. We got washed back out to sea again. Things started getting real. We're out of water. We had strange circumstances. We were all completely delirious, and we'd got in close to shore somewhere and grabbed all the kelp to try to use the kelp as an anchor. And we started drinking all the water like we thought it was a party, and we were all having the same delusional experience when we talked about it sometime later. It was just crazy. So we all wake up the next day at some point of time, and there's no water left. We've drank it all, no sign of and I don't know how it occurred, but we were nowhere near the kelp a bed that we were that evening before, and we're back out at sea again. So it was looking really, really grim. And even the most optimistic of us were starting to worry about it all, and people were finding it difficult to be motivated, and were talking about, you know, the end.
Were there ever any lighter moments on board?
One of the funniest things, I suppose, on the raft, trying to keep my morale up, was Mel McCarroll was a bookie, an SP bookie, which means he didn't have a licence. I can tell these things because Mel's passed away. And he once got arrested in the Launceston pub with a handful of $20 bills saying, "Who wants part of this? Who wants part of this? Go on, get your bets on." And the gaming squad arrested him and took him into custody over his doings. Anyway, Caulfield Cup's running in Melbourne. We had a fair idea what some of the starters would be, some of the horses, and Malcolm run the book in the life raft said, "Who wants to get on?" So we all picked a horse. None of us had a clue what the result was. So that was one of the first things we did when we got into the hospital, to find out who won the Caulfield Cup.
On air, online and podcast, this is Conversations.
We ended up back in shore again, and we thought we'd seen a road, but as we got closer, it was really just a rock formation that made it look like a road coming along the coast. But we paddled a bit further, and how we got there, I'll never know, but next thing, we're at this bay as the dawn is coming up, Deep Glen Bay, and I just made a decision, I'm not going back out to sea. So I jumped out of the raft, and thankfully the water just came up to my waist. We're that close into Deep Glen Bay. So walking along, dragging the raft behind me, we beached the raft and everybody got out of that raft as quickly as they could. And we're all falling over because our legs were not used to solid ground. Our legs and feet had been, you know, on the rubber bedding of the life raft. So none of us could stand up. We were crashing and falling all over the place. Anyway, everybody just fell over and just took a deep breath and rested for a while. Then when I got my footing, fortunately where we were at Deep Glen Bay, you can have some luck in this world, there was a fresh water stream. So you need water. You can live without food, but water is everything to you. So that was a fantastic bit of luck. So I said, I'm going to walk up these hills and see if I can find civilization. And someone said, well, we're never going to get out of this canyon. Why don't we get back in the raft and paddle around? And I said, I'm not getting back in that raft. And I'll tell you to make sure we're not getting it. I went and got a knife and I cut the raft up. And I made clothes out of it. I made a lap and a jacket type of thing to keep the wind out. So once I made these clothes, I walked up. And before I went, Taz Leary, the bosun, said, here's $10. See if you can find a shop and buy some cigarettes. So I stuck the $10 down my jocks, which wouldn't have been the nicest place in the world to be, even for a $10 note. So I walked for about 3 or 4 hours, kept climbing, kept falling, climbing. It was just dense bush with rock on both sides of the canyon or the bay. So I came back down and then the skipper went for a walk. He got lost. And then we tried again that afternoon to go up the other side of the bay, on the eastern side of the bay. Mick Powell fell. And we think he broke some ribs. The chief mate, Ken Jones, fell. We think he broke his ankle. So we sent them back, comfort each other to go back. And myself, Alf Simpson, the cook, and Malcolm McCarroll, we kept going. And we hit sheer rock straight up and down. None of us were in a fit state to take that challenge. So we said, we'll go back. And as we're walking back, we said, let's just rest all day tomorrow and then we'll work out where we're going to go. So when I came back, there were a few of the lads were just laying around who hadn't gone on the walk. The captain was back. He was completely vague on where he'd been and what he'd been doing. He was obviously delirious, so he's laid down as well. So I said, where's Ken and John, the engineer? They said, oh, they're down the beach. So I walked down. Ken Jones is sitting on a rock looking out to sea, taking his cardigan off. And I walked over to say, what are you doing there? Come up here. And he was dead. He just looking out to sea, passed away. He was a remarkable person. I didn't have much time or respect for the captain, but this bloke was a leader, and the moment he got in the raft, he took control. He just oozed with confidence and leadership, and I would hasten to say that if it wasn't for him, the motivation and the work effort and whatever would have been a totally different place. He was a great, great man, and I was very sad to see him die. Then I went to look for John Eagles, who was the chief engineer. And again, he took his overalls off. There was this thing about people taking their clothes off, these two guys anyway, and he took his clothes off and was laying face down on the beach, been washed up and down the beach. And he'd been there for not a hell of a long time, but he wasn't in a very good condition. So I dragged him up the beach. There was nothing we could do. He'd deceased. He's passed away. So we all came to the conclusion that we've got to get out of here. But none of us were fit enough to go. So we all just slept, I think probably for 24 hours, hardly moved. And all of us had the same dreams about helicopters landing on the beach and picking us up. And it was a eerie, strange circumstance. We were sort of connected, but no one spoke a word to each other for the whole period. We were just laying on our backs, hardly moved, no food, just water. And Malcolm McCarroll and myself, who were probably at that point the most fittest out of it all, said, we're just going to have to push on and just keep going, and I'd rather die trying than just dying here on this beach, because we'd already lost two. And I figured it wasn't much longer before there'd be others, and I wouldn't pick them, but I know in my head who would have been next. So we just announced to everybody that we're going, and we'll bust through or we'll just fail. And Al Simpson, the cook, said, I'm coming with you. Well, we didn't want to take Alf because he was a big man. Just come out of the Navy, but he's a big, big frame bloke. And we'd seen the bush, and we'd seen what we had seen as a difficult terrain, and we thought Alf would just slow us down, but he wasn't having anything of it. And he said, I'm coming with you. So the three of us headed off, and we went up the left bank in the western area. And surprisingly, we did find a bit of a cavity to get through and to get out of the rocky area. But that just then presented us with this, I've never seen bush like it. I don't think human beings have been in there, or white fellas haven't been in there. So everywhere we walked, poor old Alf would fall through the canopy and crashing down, 10 feet sometimes, the canopy above the, all the bush, all the trees that had fallen down, ferns everywhere. So we walked for as long as we could. We did make a lot of progress, not at all, hours and hours, and I don't know how many, 100 metres, few hundred metres or whatever. But anyway, we pressed on and we pressed on. It got too dark to go any further, so we found a big, massive big tree, and in its root structure, we made a bed with fern leaves and put them over us, and surprisingly enough, we had a pretty good night's sleep. So then we headed off the next day, and we're all pretty, really drained. We had no water by now, and we had no food. So we just kept walking and walking and walking, and then lo and behold, we walk out of the bush, and here's a dirt track. Seeing a dirt track, got no idea how enthralling just a dirt road is to someone who's been, in the circumstances we're in. So we said, all roads lead somewhere. So Alf said, let's go left. So we agreed with Alf, and he said, I'll get going first because I'm too slow. I'll get started. So Malcolm and I stayed for a bit more of a chin wag, and then we just paused for a second, and I could hear something. I said, Malcolm, don't just hold up. Don't say another word. I was strained to listen. Then I could hear a gear change of something, a car, a truck or something. And I said, there's a car or a truck or something, and I don't know where it's coming from. And Alphys just kept walking. He didn't pick up on it. And we were just so frightened that this truck would piss off if it seen us because of the disappointment we'd had everywhere else. I said, just wait. Just wait till the very last minute and we'll jump out. Don't let him get by. So, because I was still covered in the raft that I chopped up, so I looked a pretty ordinary creature, and Malcolm wasn't much better. So finally this truck comes down. It's got really, really close, and then we just ran out in front. He just hit the brakes, and I ran down as best I could, jumped on the side of his window and said, don't go. We're off the Bly Star. And his response was, you're dead. I said, no, we're not. We made here, and we made up there. We jumped in the car, and he had minties. That's all he had. So we got a handful of minties and started chewing them, and we got Alfie Simpson and picked him up in the truck. His name was Rod Smith, the truck driver. I'll never forget his name. And we got in the truck. They took us to Denali Post Office, which lacks a fortune because the post officer's husband was a fisherman and knew the waters very, very well. Well, the search and rescue, unbeknownst to us at the time, had told the fishermen to keep out of the search area because they didn't want confused signals and search patterns being stuffed up. So we're trying to identify where our mates are, because we didn't know it was Deep Glen Bay. We didn't know whereabouts. We knew rough idea whereabouts it was in Tasmania. So this guy, the fisherman, the postmistress's husband, he said, describe what it looks like. So he'd done this and that. Says there's a big rock in the middle and there's big rocks up that side and there's a freshwater stream. Says we said freshwater stream. He said, that's Deep Glen Bay. So they rang the coppers. Coppers came, or police came. We got taken to Hobart Hospital, and so we're unaware of what stage the others were. And so the helicopter went straight to Deep Glen Bay, picked up the survivors, and the police stayed there overnight with the deceased, and then they flew them out the next day.
But how did you deal with it? You know, you're 18 years old, and you're just having your first serious girlfriend. I mean,
yep.
What happened in those first weeks after this ordeal?
Yes, well, it was painful because you kept making judgments on whether you could have done more for those that died, or what if we'd done something else, or you know. But every time I'd still reconcile, there was nothing more any of us could have done. I sort of had trouble. There is an unwritten code that you never give anybody up, you don't tell tales and you don't do what. But I wasn't very impressed with the captain's role in the whole thing. He wasn't on the bridge when the ship sunk. That's why there was no mayday sent out. He showed no leadership at all during the whole episode in the raft. So I gave evidence that I didn't think he was a fit and proper character. So I went through a bit of criticism from some. But my response was three people died because of that bloke's incompetency, and he shouldn't get away with it. And if I've called it wrong, well, then I'll wear the flak.
How hard was it for you to get back out to sea?
I went back to sea. Firstly, I was kept ashore by the commission into the sinking of the ship. So I couldn't go back to sea, and I eventually went back to sea. And the first ship I joined was a ship called the Poulter, which was a small ship running down to Tasmania. And it rolled like buggery. It would roll on grass, this thing. And I'd done it really hard with the rolling. Never forget seeing the water over my porthole. It was all I could do to not to say, I've got to get off this ship. So I stayed. I weathered it out for 6 weeks, done my stint. From that point on, I sort of got over it. I got on with it. Now, I've never spoke like this anywhere, other than I was encouraged by the National Secretary of the Seamen's Union to go and address a conference of sea survival at the Australian Maritime College in Launceston. And he said to me, I want you to go down and talk about your experiences and what your recommendations are and what your, you know, general. And it took me, I think, I was probably 25, 26, something like that. It took me days and days and days to write my speech and my notes. And that's the only other place I've ever talked about it with any detail. My son, who's a seafarer, went down to the Australian Maritime College to do his pre-sea training. And one of the subject matters is sea survival, and case study being the Bligh Star. It was the first time he heard about it. When he was down at the college, Michael Dolman. His name's Michael Dolman. So I've since had a father and son discussion about it all with him, but I'm not a person that holds court on this subject matter. It's too serious. Three people lost their lives. Some didn't go back to sea. Some could have lived longer than they did. I'm the last survivor out of that crew. So I've always treated it with great respect and not turned it into something you can dine out on for the next 20 years or so.
It seems to me like you might be downplaying what was an extremely traumatic thing that occurred very early in your career.
I have no bones about it. It was traumatic. And the weather, sharks, all those things, constant threat every day. When the raft was constantining and smashing each other around in it, is this thing going to hold up? Is it going to collapse on us? You were constantly under threat the whole time, and I would say probably two or three occasions very close to it, to death in that period. But we pushed on and we got going. So I think, I know there's an old saying, what don't kill you makes you stronger, and I think there is some truth in that too, but you still carry those lessons with you all your life in terms of how you conducted yourself and the comrades that didn't make it. And neither of them deserved it. None of them, you know, it was so strange that they passed as they did. Particularly Ken, who swam out of the ship. I mean, getting out of a ship that's sinking and getting on board and just taking over almost straight away. He just got himself out of one life-threatening circumstances, jumps it, gets into the life raft and throwing orders around or, you know, directions around all over the place. I would have loved to have seen him get through and get back to his family, as I would the two Johns, the engineers who passed away.
What do you think it was? Was it just exhaustion? These were older gentlemen. Yeah. They weren't as young as you. Yeah. I mean, what was it, do you think?
I was exhausted, and I was fit, 18-year-old. I used to play football and looked after myself. I was exhausted physically and mentally, and I can only imagine that that was just it. They had enough. They just had enough. And Ken in particular, sitting on a rock just looking out to sea, sitting up like he was just asleep. And, I can only put it down to that. Exhaustion and fatigue.
There's another thing that came from the Blythe Star, in my understanding, and after the Royal Commission and recommendations, there were actually changes that were made to navigational reporting systems because mm-hmm. of what happened to that ship. Yep. Could you explain that?
Well, two very critical things came out, and one was that all life rafts and lifeboats have to have EPIRBs, that's the emergency positioning radio beacons, and the second one was OSREP, where because the ship didn't tell where they were going, the search pattern was much, much bigger and delayed any rescue. In fact, nobody found us except that truck driver. We found him. So at the end of the day, we saved ourselves. And I'm not being critical of the search, but we got our own way ashore, got our own way up to that road. So now what happens, a ship has to identify with AMSA, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, that this is a route they're taking, and every 24 hours or so there has to be a report that where your progress is. Any deviation, you have to notify them. So it greatly narrows the search area and the time. If a ship doesn't respond, then they'll start making calls about it. I'm not completely clear on the crank up to actual full-scale search, but it certainly wouldn't have been as long as it took for the Blythe Star search to get underway. So that's a fantastic outcome out of it, and that's good.
And what about you? You mean you didn't talk about it and you pushed on. You still went seafaring and you've actually, in fact, made a whole career about the sea. Mm. How did you do that? Most people would give it the boot.
Yeah. Well, all I ever wanted to do was to go to sea. I loved it and still do love it, even though I haven't been to sea as an occupation for a long time, since 1984. There was nothing else I wanted to do. I love the camaraderie, I love ships, I love the environment that I work in. The biggest test was the Poulter, the first ship back to sea. That was the biggest test, and it was a very small ship. If I got over that, I figured I could get over anything. And from that point on, I'd been through at sea in cyclones, in all sorts of weather and what have you, and I've never ever felt, other than the Poulter, never ever felt uncomfortable or nauseated by been at sea, not at all. So, yes, I did get over it. I don't speak about it, and my interest shifted too because I became a very political person. I care about human rights, I care about labour rights, trade union rights, and from a very young man, I sort of took up a large proportion of my thought processes and things I wanted to do. So I had plenty of things to dwell on that were much more important than worrying about something that I had no control over and was a circumstance that it's done, it's dusted, move on.
Is it a case of what doesn't kill you makes you a better union official?
Yes, I think it does. I think I learned a lot about how to manage myself in terms of getting my temper under some control. I learned a lot about how to talk and communicate with people in an appropriate way to get the best out of them for the best circumstances I might be articulating at the time. And it sort of subconsciously opened... People respected me a bit more, I think, because of that circumstance, even though they know I've never spoken about it or never tried to leverage off it. Never, ever. But in maritime circles, if you're a survivor out of a shipwreck, you're regarded as someone that's done something a bit special if you've, you know, has survived and what have you.
So it didn't diminish your fondness for the ocean?
No, not at all. Quite the opposite, actually. I respect the ocean. It is enormous, beautiful water. It's deadly if you treat it badly. If you don't understand what it's capable of doing, you'll be taken by the sea. If you go to sea on a ship or whatever, or a surfboard or wherever it may be, you've got to have respect for that ocean because it can do some pretty powerful things.
This is Conversations on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Michael Dolman is the last surviving crew member of the Blythe Star, which went down off the coast of Tasmania back in 1973. I recorded that conversation with Michael last year, and there's more on the Blythe Star story on my own program website, Off Track. This is Conversations, and I'm Anne Jones.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.